Welcome to Stand in the Gap Today with your host, the Honorable Sam Rohrer, President of the American Pastors Network, addressing the most pressing issues impacting our economy, our homes, our churches, our culture, and our daily lives from a biblical and constitutional perspective. Stand in the Gap Today, transforming the culture one heart at a time.
Well, hello, I'm Sam Rohrer, and today our theme for this program will be this: Trouble Now, More Trouble Ahead, The Future and the Legacy of Islam. On Stand in the Gap Today, we attempt to choose leading news of the day as it may appear on front page news or selected by the controlled media, and we evaluate those in the light of Scripture and the Constitution. We, of course, are always challenged in that we can't cover everything in a one-hour program, so we're forced to choose carefully. But we try to choose those things, ladies and gentlemen, that we believe are of the most significant impact and life-changing impact on those who love our nation and those who, like you who are listening, grateful to God for the freedoms by which He's blessed us as a nation. And often these subjects are controversial, but we don't shy away from that because in reality, nothing is of real significance and importance unless it has some controversy associated with it. So it's in that in mind that our focus today are on events here in the United States in segment 1 and 2 and in segments 3 and 4 in the Middle East. Interestingly, the source of the controversy in both portions of this program today is Mohammedan Islam, which has as its goal total world domination and subjugation of all non-Muslims, not just Christians and Jews. So with me today is co-host evangelist Dave Kistler. He is the president of our North Carolina Pastors Network chapter and president of Hope Ministries located in Washington, D.C. And our expert guest for this first half in segments 1 and 2 will be Leo Homan. He's an independent reporter specializing in refugee resettlement and Islamic migration into the West. He's also the author of the recent book, Stealth Invasion, and his blogs can be found at leohoman.com. Now, in the second half of today's program, I'm going to bring in E.J. Kimball. He's the director of Israel Victory Project. It's a project of the Middle East Forum, where we're going to get the latest on peace talks in the Middle East and where the problems there lie. We're going to conclude with a quick overview of recent events in Turkey. Now, get this, and why this nation might just emerge as the next and even bigger version of the Islamic State. Now, that being said, Dave, let me jump right into Islam here in America, the trouble it's already created, and the predictable likelihood of much more trouble ahead. Yesterday on this program, Dave, you and I and Gary Dahl were on here, and we launched that program by citing some basic findings from a January 3rd Pew Research study about Muslims in America being on track to become the second largest religion in America within 20 years. We did not go into the specifics of Islam or the Quran at that point because we went the other direction and wanted to establish the impact historically and practically of the Bible and Judeo-Christian ideology on the shaping of America. And we looked at specific examples in two areas, education and government. But today I am wanting to focus on the realities of Islam, not as a religion it tends to hide behind, but as the political system that it really is, and that has been trouble for all non-Muslims, but particularly Christians and Jews, and why trouble ahead is assured if we don't wake up. Dave, you're an expert on Islam. You speak about it. You take the Bible. You compare what the Bible says to what Islam is, and it's been extraordinarily helpful in what you are doing. But I want you to comment in just a second, but let me read just a bit from these research on Pew and set it up here. It says this from the report, quote, based on our own survey and demographic research, as well as outside sources, Pew Research Center estimates that there are about 3.45 million Muslims of all ages living in the United States in 2017. That equates to about 1.1% of the total population. Muslims in the U.S. are not as numerous as the number of Americans who identify as Jewish by religion, according to our estimate. But it goes ahead and says by 2040, though, Muslims will replace Jews as the nation's second largest religious group. And by 2050, the Muslim population projected to reach 8.1 million, twice what it is right now. Dave, my question to you right off here, a quick response is, how do you see when this happens, not so much if or when, but when this happens, what impact are we going to see on America if, in fact, the Muslim population surpasses that of the Jewish population?
Well, Sam, all one has to do is take a perusal of what Islam has done in other countries where they have not been in the majority. And they move through three stages. There's an accommodation stage where, as they're growing in number and influence, they treat the host country, i.e. America, you're okay, we're okay, everybody's fine, you know, we worship the same God, we just call him by a different name. But as they grow in number and influence, they move to an agitation stage where they begin agitating for their rights. They begin not allowing any slight against the Prophet Muhammad or the religion of Islam to go unchecked or unnoted. There are protests that take place, and I think anyone that's watching this closely would say America is thoroughly ensconced in stage two. But the third stage is the subjugation stage, where either via violent jihad or stealth jihad, more likely, they begin to take over all aspects of a country. They run for office. They get involved in the judicial and the political system. And we're already watching that take place in America. So, Sam, long term is this: if this projection is accurate, and by 2050, we have 8.1% of our population identifying themselves as Muslim, we are in for a lot of trouble.
Okay, you're just citing history and facts there, Dave. I know that. Let me go to Leo right now for some commentary on this. You're an investigative reporter, Leo. You specialize in this area. You've written the book Stealth Invasion. I know it connects very closely with what Dave was saying. I want to ask you this. As you see this research being evidenced, and you hear Dave's comments based on your own knowledge, can our constitutional republic survive if the Muslim Islamic population achieves these goals as indicated by the Pew Research Report?
Absolutely not, Sam. In fact, you know, when the Pew Research study, for starters, is very conservative, saying we have 3.45 million Muslims in our country. CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, which, as you know, is the major voice of Muslims in America, says that we have 5 to 8 million Muslims already in America. My guess is that the true figure is somewhere between the Pew Research number and the CARE number. We probably have 4 to 5 million Muslims already in America, which means that they are already close to replacing Judaism as the second most common populist religion in America. There's about 5.3, 5.4 million Jews in America. So let's take that Pew number as just one estimate, because there's many out there. Nobody knows the true figure, because the census does not collect data on people's religion. So, okay. Yes, we are in for some changes.
All right, Leo Homan, Pendant reporter, and Dave, you know, we both agree, if the numbers are achieved as indicated by Pew, which Leo says is probably understated, we do have trouble with the continuance of America as we know it. Now, when we come back in the next segment, we're going to talk with Leo in depth about examples of the trouble that Islam has brought and is bringing, even very recently, although not covered in the press, right here in the United States. Stay tuned. We're going to share some of this with you.
Hello, this is Sam Rohr. Although the term Christian education doesn't occur in the Bible, it does speak of the moral and spiritual instruction of children. It places a high value on knowledge, both of God and His works. It describes the moral and spiritual fruits of this knowledge and defines its ultimate purpose, the growth of your child in godliness of character and action. That's why we suggest you consider BJU Press K-12 materials. Your child's a unique individual created for a specific purpose. Proper instruction that includes the Bible and the relational influence of godly teachers produces a pure heart and a willing mind. The Bible calls that success. BJU Press materials are well written, grade level appropriate, and biblically integrated. They teach critical thinking skills and keep your child engaged and excited about learning. If you're a Christian school teacher or administrator, a homeschool teacher, or a parent who just wants your child to learn more, start by exploring the BJU Press website. Visit bjupress.com. That's bjupress.com.
Thank you, Sam, and thank you to the team that you have working with you. I'll tell you one thing about your show. You accomplish more in less time to advance the gospel and to advance knowledge and understanding of seriously any radio show I know of. So congratulations.
Those kind words from Congressman Michelle Bachmann summarize what our guests say about Stand in the Gap today. This is Sam Rohr. On this program, we bring honest analysis of today's news to you and millions of Americans every day. With a newspaper in one hand and the Word of God in the other, we connect the dots between what's happening and what God says about what's happening in light of the Bible and the Constitution. From the mouths of our co-hosts, all preachers, whether former members of the House of Representatives or an evangelist to a millennial pastor or a senior pastor of 40 years, Stand in the Gap today is here for you. Unique, current, trustworthy. Pray for us. Stand with us financially by going to standinthegapradio.com.
You're listening to Stand in the Gap today. For more information, visit our website at standinthegapradio.com.
The projected rise of Islam in America, and we're citing a January 3rd research poll from Pew, they estimate that there are right now 3.5 million Muslims in America, projected a good 8 million. Leo Homan, our guest, says that that number is probably low. So take that into account, ladies and gentlemen. But it's alarming no matter how you look at it. As a competing political system, Mohammedan Islam's Sharia law is in direct constitution here in America. The concept of self-government that we have here is repudiated and outlawed in Islam, let alone the differences that are there in economics, in finances, education, private property, rights of women. All of those things contained in the United States Constitution are in direct opposition to that which is pushed and promoted by Sharia under Islam. But even more than this is the aggressive pursuit to dominate and subjugate all who do not bow the knee to Islam. And this is where the trouble really explodes. And it's where we've been seeing it here in the Middle East, in Europe, as well here in the United States, although the controlled media does its best to cover up these examples. Now, to share some of the examples of trouble carried out and, yes, encouraged by Islamic imams in mosques across this country, I want to officially invite now back in Leo Homan. He's an independent investigative reporter. He specializes in refugee resettlement issues and Islamic migration into the West. He's author of the recent book, Stealth Invasion. And you can find his blogs at Leo Homan, H-O-H-M-A-N-N, leohoman.com. So, Leo, I'm going to bring you back in right now, and I want to ask you to go right into some examples here.
Sure.
From your investigations into Islam in America, refugee resettlement, and all of that that you've been written about, and you're perhaps the leading reporter on this, what have you found to be the occurrences of Islamic attacks against people or property here in America? Is it a problem that we should be concerned about, or is it a little problem that we should just ignore? Leo Homan, tell us. What do you think?
Absolutely, Sam. It's really very simple. Countries that have very little to no Islamic immigration have little to no terrorism. You can look at Hungary, Poland, Japan, countries that do not import Islamic refugees or migrants of any sort. Do not have Islamic terrorism, period. Okay, so America does do this, not to the extent that Germany has gone off on a tangent recently in the last 3 years, importing like 1.5 million Muslim migrants in a 2.5 year period. But take Germany out of the equation, and I would say that the U.S. is right up there in the top three, if not the I would say right behind Germany over the years and the numbers, okay? And we do have specific examples. I could take a week and not hit all of them, so I'll just hit some of the most recent highlights of these sort of low-level pinprick attacks that don't get any publicity in the media like a huge 9/11 event would, but by the same token cause fear in the local population. Just a year and a half ago, in St. Cloud, Minnesota, in September 2016, less than a year and a half ago, Mr. Dahir Adan, a Somali Muslim refugee, went on a stabbing spree at the Crossroads Center Mall. He stabbed 10 people. He asked them first if they were Muslim. If they said yes, he moved on to someone else. If they said no, I'm Christian, they got stabbed. He injured severely 10 people, two or three of them were in critical condition. He would have killed several, I'm sure, were it not for the fact that an off-duty policeman was there and shot him dead on the scene. Okay, that was September 2016. Then we come to August of 2017 at the Mall of America in Bloomington, Minnesota. Another Somali refugee tries to, we're told, goes into the dressing room at a Macy's store and attacks with a knife two brothers who were severely injured in that knife attack. And then on June 26th of last year at a house party in, again, St. Cloud, one mile from St. Cloud State University, Davy DeVos, a 20-year-old American, was stabbed and killed. Stabbed to death by a 16-year-old Somali living in that community, Somali Muslim. On December 3rd, now we're getting real recently, December 13th, just a few weeks ago, Miss Morgan Evanson, a young lady of 24 years old, who worked at the Apple store in Minneapolis, was walking home from work at 8:30 at night. She was attacked from behind by a man she described as having a slight Somali accent, of thin build and wearing gray stonewashed jeans. He proceeded to stab her 14 times, Sam, all over her torso, arms, and shoulders, while she fought him off and screamed, and if it were not for the fact that a passerby, a young man, heard her screams and came to her aid, she would have been either raped or more likely raped and killed, because the police played this off as a failed robbery. But the young lady told the world in a video, he did not even go for my purse that was sitting on my shoulder.
I don't want to interrupt, but let me ask you something very, very quickly. These are stunning illustrations that you are giving, and they're often not reported, or when they are reported, exactly as you said, they are blamed on something else, such as a failed robbery attempt. The problem that we see here and that we've talked about on the program in the past is, where is this incitement to violence coming from? Frequently, the news will say these people were radicalized. That is the popular term, radicalized online. And yet we know that in many of the mosques of America, there is incitement to this kind of violence coming from the mosque. If you were to do a casual Google search, just entering in something like this, Imams Call for Insurrection in America, you would have instantly popping up over 99,000 examples where imams are inciting violence. Can you give some specifics with respect to that, where imams in a mosque have incited, encouraged this kind of violence?
Well, you're absolutely right. And by the way, I just wanted to give one other quick example. Just last week, January 5th, an elderly woman, 73 years old, who was volunteering at a homeless shelter in Shelburne, Vermont, was attacked by a Somali with a machete, okay, and she is in the hospital still, I believe, with severe leg wounds. Now, you're asking about specific examples of imams or preachers of hate who are preaching at mosques. Let's start by saying that 85% of the imams in our country are foreign-born. They're the worst of the worst. Many of the more peaceful imams stay home in the Middle East. The worst, most radical ones come to the U.S. and other Western countries to spread Islam, because that is giving them points in the life hereafter with Allah, who loves imams who spread Islam to non-Islamic countries, according to the Quran and the Hadith. However, let's just go, just recently, a Houston imam was caught citing the famous anti-Semitic hadith where the judgment day will not come, this hadith says, until the Muslims fight the Jews. And the Muslims will, they will continue to fight them until they are no more. In fact, this hadith says that the Jews will hide behind a tree or a stone, and if Allah wills it, that tree and stone will shout out, "Oh Muslim, there is a Jew hiding behind me," and the Muslim come and kill him. Okay, so this is direct incitement. Houston imam was recently caught. You can go to Memory, the Middle East media tracking website, to see the video of that imam. Another one in North Carolina recently cited the same anti-Semitic hadith. which is attributed to the Prophet Muhammad. By the way, that's what the Hadith are. They are a collection of the sayings of Muhammad. There was another imam in Davis, California, last July, who was caught citing the same anti-Jewish hatred and using this citation from the Hadith. And he ended up having to apologize. When they're caught on video, usually, that Jewish Anti-Defamation League will call them out, and they will oftentimes apologize. But we know that these apologies are not sincere. And I think, Dave, you mentioned those three stages. I think in America, those three stages of Islamic subjugation, we're caught between stage two and three, or maybe even in some states between stage one and two. And that's why you will see a little confusion on the part of the Islamic imams in our country, because they'll look at an imam who gets away with something in one state and think they can do it in their state, but that state is not quite to the same stage, so they end up having to apologize. And that's what happened with the Texas imams and the California imam. But we don't see many apologies coming out of Minnesota, because in my opinion, Minnesota is the first subjugated state that we have.
All right, Leo, I'm going to step in right now because we have about 15 seconds before we go in the break. I have to say goodbye to you, but this question always comes up. These are lone wolf examples that you gave. Even the imams you cite are an anomaly. Is it an anomaly, or is this really what the true Muhammadism, Quran, and the Hadith are actually telling Muslims to do?
Absolutely. The Hadith are ranked on the basis of credibility, and this particular Hadith that they all cite against the Jews is on the top level of most credible Hadith.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to Stand in the Gap today. I'm Sam Rohr. Dave Kessler's the co-host today, and we just had Leo Homan, independent investigative reporter. You can find these blogs at leohoman.com. Now, when we come back, we're going to usher in our new guest, E.J. Kimball. He is the director of the Israel Victory Project, a division of the Middle East Forum. And we're going to go to the Middle East, and we're going to ask him to give us an update on the peace process and, again, the trouble that is there because of Islamic thought and teaching.
You're listening to Stand in the Gap today, discussing the pressing issues facing our culture from a biblical and constitutional perspective. Now let's rejoin our host.
Good afternoon and welcome again here to Stand in the Gap today. This is Sam Rohr. If you're just joining us, we're glad that you are with us here at the midpoint in this program. Our theme today is Trouble Now, More Trouble Ahead, the Future and the Legacy of Islam. We spoke and had some time in this first half on events and things that are happening here in the United States. We're going to go to the Middle East now and talk about what's happening there with Israel and all that's surrounding that in the peace process with a special guest, E.J. Kimball, who I'll more formally introduce in just a second. Now, if you've joined us and you did not hear the first half, I encourage you, go to our website, standinthegapradio.com. You can pick up this archive in a couple of hours from doing this program right now. Or if you've not downloaded our free app, I encourage you to do that. Your smartphone, Android, or iPhone, just go to your app store and put in the phrase, Stand in the Gap, download the app, and then you can listen to this program at your convenience at a later time. Now, with that, I want to now go into our second half of this program as we move to the Middle East. The theme, as I said, is Trouble Now, More Trouble Ahead, the Future and the Legacy of Islam. We talked about the many examples of death and destruction caused by adherence to Muhammad's Hadith and the Quran, as presented to us by independent reporter Leo Homan. But this undeniable current and increasing future trouble created by this anti-Bible, anti-Christian, anti-Jewish, and anti-Israel ideology is nearly the singular cause of trouble and unrest in the Middle East as we look to that part of the world. And to look at the current affairs of Israel, and specifically peace process impacts, and for what I'm going to suggest in this next segment, the potential new leader for a worldwide Islamic caliphate, now that ISIS has been driven out of Iraq and Syria, there's a country that's emerging. We're going to talk about that with our special guest as well. So with that, I want to welcome in E.J. Kimball. He is the director of the Israel Victory Project. It's a division of Middle East Forum, which you can find at their website, of meforum.org. And with that, I welcome to the program E.J. Kimball. Thanks for being back with us.
Sam, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me on again.
Well, E.J., you have a good handle, and perhaps one of the best handles in what's happening in the Middle East. And I'd like you to go right now to the issue of the peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians. Clearly, it's a goal, as we've talked before, of the president and Jared Kushner, who's working in that regard. The president made it clear on December 6th, E.J., when he recognized Jerusalem as Israel's rightful and eternal capital city, that he was going to do things differently because up to this point, nothing has worked. So he said, we're going to change it. And he recognized Jerusalem as the capital. But he also said he thought a peace treaty would end up being a reality. What's the status of peace talks there in the Middle East now? And what really has the president's December 6th announcement done? Sped up the process, hindered the process, or just tell us, what do you think?
Well, at the moment, there's not much of a peace process happening. There's really no discussions. Part of the decision, I believe, in recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and essentially taking it off the table from the negotiations was to spur the Palestinian Authority to essentially get real in the negotiations. The demands that the Palestinian Authority has made over the last 30 years during these negotiations would give the impression that they have won every war against Israel, and Israel is barely holding on for its survival and only survives because the Palestinian Authority allows it to, which is obviously counterfactual to reality. So after going through a peace process for months and months and seeing these demands, President Trump took this action in part to show the Palestinians that they need to start living in reality and to negotiate in good faith. What has happened since is the Palestinian Authority has doubled down, and they have refused to negotiate. And the most recent actions on this issue relate to some tweets that President Trump put forward calling for cutting off aid to the Palestinian Authority, saying, you know, if they're not willing to negotiate, why are we giving them money? And that was capitalized at the beginning of this month when the United States did not send the first third of our annual payment to UNRWA, the UN agency that specifically deals with Palestine refugees, about $130 million. That is not frozen technically yet. It's not due until, I believe, Monday, but it is being held in my mind and from some sources that I've spoken with as a means to get the Palestinian Authority back to the negotiating table. So in a nutshell, there's not much going on in the peace process at the moment, but President Trump is dedicated to getting the ultimate deal, and he is looking to do whatever he can to get the sides to come to an agreement.
EJ, let me ask you this. Back before the end of last year, Sam and I sat in a meeting with several Israeli Knesset members, and they said unequivocally that there is no point in attempting to sit down and negotiate with people that are sitting across the table from you who are intent on killing you if they have the opportunity to do so. Now, that statement is as clear as it can be, and it makes perfect sense. Is there any possibility whatsoever that on the Palestinian side there is any change in their thinking with respect to that, understanding that the Israelis say there's no point in sitting down with somebody who's going to try to kill us if they can? Is that changing anything from the Palestinian viewpoint?
Nothing has changed from that. And to be clear, I do not expect any negotiations right now to result in a deal, no matter what sort of leverage is placed on the Palestinian Authority. Simply, and this is what the Israel Victory Project puts forward, which is the Palestinian Authority believes that they can still destroy Israel. They believe that they can still win their war. So why would they give up on that objective at a negotiating table when they've got every reason to believe they can still win? And what President Trump has done is said to them, no, you can't win. So now come to this negotiation knowing that you've lost, and now what is it that you ultimately want to get knowing that you can't win? Now, they have not accepted that reality yet, and that's what the Israel Victory Project proposes, which is once the Palestinians accept that they've lost, that they will not destroy Israel, then they can actually come to a table and make a deal with Israel that will work for both sides, and that can ultimately lead to them prospering in the future. But at the moment, right, what the MK said, which is, what are we negotiating for? They will not accept anything less than the destruction of the Jewish state of Israel.
Okay, EJ, so you've laid it out very clearly, and it's what we just talked about. As long as they hold that position, you're not going to have a peace agreement. But not only the Palestinians doing that, now EU leaders and United Nations leaders have just recently came out and they told Israeli leaders that they needed to plan on and accept the reality, they say, of a divided Jerusalem. Benjamin Netanyahu said no way. Other Israeli leaders said that as well. But are you finding that there is a clear ongoing linkage in the opposition to any peace talks or where Israel's recognized, not just coming from the Palestinians, but from United Nations and EU leaders? And if so, why? What's their beef there with recognizing Israel?
Well, I think the best way to sum up this whole question is to paraphrase Congressman Juan Vargas, Democrat from California and a co-chair of the Congressional Israel Victory Caucus. When asked what should the United States do to push the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations to end the conflict, he said, we shouldn't be pushing them. We should be saying to Israel, what is it that you want? We support Israel. And that's the whole crux of this, which is Israel is the party that shares our interests, shares our values. Palestinian Authority does not. They're funding, there was a murder of a father of six the other day in one of the West Bank areas, and the Palestinian Authority is celebrating it. And this person, who is now ultimately going to go to jail in Israel, will start receiving payments from the Palestinian Authority for his heroic act of murdering in cold blood a father of six. That's not something that we share. So, no, we should not be trying to help a side that validates that behavior. The European Union, the United Nations, the blocs there, they're not interested in peace. They're interested in punishing Israel, and they have an ideological problem accepting the reality that Israel is the homeland of the Jewish people. They've come back after 2,000 years. They're here. They're strong. They just can't rationalize that there is going to have to be a side that loses in this war, just like there was a side that lost in World War II. But they just have a mental block getting over that. And, the world opinion is shifting against the Palestinians, specifically from the Arab world.
I tell you, there's a lot we could go right there. But ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to Stand in the Gap today. Our special guest right now is E.J. Kimball. He's the director of Israel Victory Project, a division of the Middle East Forum, and been on with us before, but his insights here are very, very clear. Until the Palestinians, and really the Arabs and the Muslims, agree that Israel has a right to exist, you're not going to have peace, you're going to have trouble. And at this point, they've not come to that point. Now, when we come back, we're going to talk about this emerging country that could and may want to take the place of ISIS. Who is it? We'll talk about it when we come back.
Christian parents want their children to excel in spiritual growth and educational achievement. Both are essential for future success in an increasingly complex world full of moral and economic challenges. BJU Press Materials place great value on the knowledge of God in His works. They teach critical thinking skills your child will need to get along both now and in the future. BJU Press Materials are available for grades K-12. From the earliest grades, they teach biblical Christianity as a system of God-revealed truths. BJU Press Materials are well written, grade level appropriate, and biblically integrated. Teachers' editions assure that instructors have the plans and extra tools to keep your child engaged and excited about learning by teaching your child how to analyze, evaluate, and ultimately create new solutions. And that's just what today's workplace is looking for. If you're a Christian school teacher or administrator, a homeschool teacher, or a parent who just wants your child to learn more, start by exploring the BJU Press website. Visit bjupress.com. That's bjupress.com.
Americans are a freedom-loving people. Wouldn't it be great if you could carry a copy of the essential documents that outline our freedoms written by our nation's founders in your pocket so you can refer to it every day? Well, now you can. Stand in the Gap Radio has found something you're sure to like, the Patriot's Essential Liberty Pocket Guide. The handy guide is a slim 6.5 by 3.5 inches, yet it includes the Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Constitution, the preamble to the Bill of Rights, and other influential documents, including, in the words of our founders, topical quotes from America's founders, plus a listing of online resources for further research by the serious-minded or the just plain curious. To see and request your copy of the Patriot's Essential Liberty Pocket Guide and make your tax-deductible gift of any amount, go to AmericanPastorsNetwork.net. That's AmericanPastorsNetwork.net. Let us hear from you today. Thank you, and God bless you.
You're listening to Stand in the Gap Today, the daily radio program of the American Pastors Network. For more information, visit the APN website. AmericanPastorsNetwork.net. And now, let's rejoin Stand in the Gap Today.
Well, with the routing of ISIS and its self-proclaimed Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, the logical question from a geopolitical and national security perspective is this: where will the faithful adherents to Muhammad and the Quran show up next? Are they ISIS? Al-Qaeda? Hamas? Hezbollah? Or any other new name that might arise? Because the fact remains, ladies and gentlemen, as we started this program, Islamic thought produces trouble. It does in the past, and as we've talked about here in the United States, it certainly is in the Middle East relative to the right of Israel to exist and Jerusalem and all of those things. And the question is that that body of thought is going to continue as it has from the beginning with its objective to achieve Muhammad's command to kill the Jews, kill the Christians, and subjugate and enslave the entire world for Muhammad. And with that is a goal for a worldwide Islamic caliphate, just as ISIS was trying to do. Well, is there someone else emerging right now? We're going to talk to E.J. Kimball, director of the Israel Victory Project, about his thoughts on that. E.J., there are major changes occurring in the nation of Turkey. Turkey's President Erdogan has made it clear by his own actions and words that he wants to be the leader of a new Islamic state and to lead the worldwide caliphate. And I know that Middle East Forum has written some very thoughtful articles on this topic, but I'd like to know your thoughts today if we could. Are we perhaps seeing the rise of Erdogan, President of Turkey, and Turkey perhaps as the new face of ISIS and a worldwide caliphate? What do you think?
To quickly answer, I don't believe we're seeing it as the new face of ISIS. However, Erdogan has, as you mentioned, been very clear that he sees himself as the embodiment of the new caliphate to emerge. And he has been doing everything in his power to consolidate power within Turkey to maintain his rule. There's a lot of unrest in Turkey right now. There's a lot of challenges within the U.S.-Turkey relationship, given that Turkey's a NATO ally, yet becoming very close with Russia. There's the impending sale of the F-35 to Turkey and the risk that just goes right over to Russia with our technology. So there's a lot of challenges in the relationship. Regarding ISIS itself, I want to get to that in a minute, but going back to the last segment when we finished up, about the EU and the UN response to the Jerusalem issue. And I was mentioning that in the Arab states, interestingly, there's been very little opposition to it, public opposition, little bit at the beginning. The opposition has come from Iran and Turkey. That's where the main opposition has come from. And Turkey is building itself out as the major opposition to the United States, to Israel, to these Arab states, aligning itself with its interests with Iran. And that's where I see the biggest challenge right now is that nexus. Regarding ISIS, while President Trump has fulfilled his campaign promise of destroying ISIS in Iraq and Syria, they no longer have their physical safe haven. Uh, they're selling the currency that they had printed on eBay and through various sites to try to get money to continue carrying on their jihadist attacks. I do, however, believe that ISIS, like its predecessors before them, will reemerge, you know, with a new brand. They certainly have not been eradicated from Iraq and Syria. They've melted back into the population. There are still sympathetic areas to ISIS. And they pose a different threat than Turkey does, as essentially what could be a state sponsor, the way that Iran is a state sponsor of terrorism. So ISIS, being independent, have cells around the world that they're inspiring people to their ideology, whereas Turkey is looking to be more of the leader with an established country, an established government, you know, economy, and so forth. So it's slightly different, but I think your point is right on that that Erdogan does see himself as the caliph, the future caliph of the Muslim world.
EJ, let me ask you this. With all these demonstrations that we're watching currently in Iran, is that signaling a weakening of the ruling clergy's grip on that country, and then possibly suggesting that Iran could fall and might cause them to lean more toward the West, just at the same time that Turkey is leaning more toward the East? I mean, is that a possibility?
It is. There's a big difference between the people in Turkey and the people in Iran. In Turkey, polls show anti-Americanism, anti-Europeanism, very high. You know, the favorability rating of Germany, for example, in Turkey is extremely, extremely low. In Iran, the people are not the problem. The people are not in total, but much more pro-Western. And that's because prior to 79 and the revolution there, it was a very Western-oriented country. And what we're seeing today, and the difference, I think, between what happened in 2009 with the Green Revolution, what we're seeing today is this is a response to the aftermath of the JCPOA. That was supposed to provide relief to the Iranian people. And that money has been spent on foreign adventurism, funding Hezbollah, more Hezbollah activity, getting more involved in Yemen, in Syria and Lebanon. And the people, meanwhile, are suffering more. You know, prices are going higher and higher. And you're also seeing a rejection of the ruling class. You're seeing a rejection of this theocracy. And there's definitely an opportunity here for the people to rise up and demand their freedom. I mean, that's ultimately what happens under dictatorial regimes, are the people eventually rise up and seek freedom. And it's important for our country and all those freedom countries around the world to support the people in their quest to, you know, get rid of the yoke of oppression.
EJ, your comments here are very enlightening, and that they coincide with other things we've had, the comments from other guests, former Iraqis and others, who have made a similar statement in that the people of Iran, based on the ground, are pro-Western, but also made a point at that the fact that they're not Arabs, they're Persians. And not only lean west, they really don't like praying to Mecca, because they have their own gods there, Zoroastrian background, and they don't really like writing in Arabic. So that's a unique circumstance that's happening in Iran. And unfortunately, we don't have the time to flesh this thing out, EJ. We want to have you back. But I just want to wrap it up by saying, ladies and gentlemen, you've got a lot of information on this program. I encourage you to go to standinthegapradio.com, pick up the archives, and listen to it. Dave, I'd like to ask you to close, pray for Israel, pray for Jerusalem, pray for our nation, and these things as we wrap up this program and this week, if you could.
Be delighted to, Sam. Father, thank you so much for the two guests we've had on today. Thank you for the insight they have provided. And Father, I do pray for the peace of Jerusalem. I pray, oh God, you would continue to give our leadership in the United States of America an understanding of how critically important it is that we continue to stand where our president has so unequivocally stood, and that we continue down that path. Give wisdom, Lord, from on high, and we'll thank you for it. Bless through the weekend, Father. Watch over us, protect our country, and bring us back again on Monday for another great day of programming is my prayer. In Jesus' name, amen.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being with us today. I'm Sam Rohr, Dave Kistler, and our special guest this segment, EJ Kimball. You can go find out more about him in the Middle East Forum at meforum.org. And until we come back to you on Monday with a great program, Surveillance, what we're going to talk about, Join us on Monday. Stand in the gap for truth where you are. Until then.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to Stand in the Gap Today. Stand in the Gap Today is another quality ministry of the American Pastors Network, addressing the most pressing issues affecting the culture from a biblical and constitutional perspective. We take seriously the command to be salt and light, and the mission to declare truth in the public square. Stand in the Gap Radio is supported through the prayers and tax-deductible financial gifts from listeners like you. Would you please consider a donation to help us increase our outreach of biblical truth? To learn more about us and make your donation, please visit StandInTheGapRadio.com. You may also give from our smartphone app. Download the Stand in the Gap app. Search for it in your web store under the heading Stand in the Gap. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in every weekday at the same time for Stand in the Gap Today.
If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will forgive their sin and heal their land. 2 Chronicles 7:14. WFYL reminds you to pray for America.